This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. If you're looking for some light reading this week, you might want to check out the latest publication from the State Auditor's Office. It's called Vermont Health Connect, Future Improvement Contingent on Successful System Development Project. Catchy title, eh? That's the report the Auditor's Office just put out on its performance audit of the state's healthcare exchange website and the back-end system that website is designed to interact with. The system has suffered from massive problems since it went online a year and a half ago, and the state's been trying to correct them while keeping the system online. If you read the report, you'll see one phrase jump out at you several different times. There are significant uncertainties that affect whether this date can be met. This date refers to May 30th, the planned release date for the first of two major system upgrades. The second major release is scheduled for this fall. It's at that point the Shumlin administration says we'll know if Vermont Health Connect can be saved or if the state will need to cut over to the federal exchange. So how did we get here, and what specifically needs to be fixed to get the system working as intended? We're joined today by Doug Hoffer, the state auditor, and by Linda Lambert, also with the auditor's office. She's the director of information technology and performance audits, and she was the manager for the Vermont Health Connect audit. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
So let's start with the timeline. And just to remind people, the state and federal exchanges were all mandated to go online on October 1st of 2013. Now, people will probably remember that immediately there were problems not just in Vermont, but with the federal exchange and with many of the state exchanges. Vermont's problems, though, never seemed to really get fixed. And on October 1st of 2014, we switched contractors from CGI to Optum. Now we're still seeing problems, and the governor has set this first goal for the end of May to have a major system upgrade and then a second set of major upgrades to be completed this fall. In terms of how the state has improved the situation from October 1st of 2013 to today, Doug Hoffer, are there any bright spots?
Oh, no question. And I think perhaps the most important, is this on?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I think perhaps the most important, Linda, I think you would agree, is the attention devoted to project management, because everything really starts with that. If that's not in place and well organized, then everything that flows from it will be a mess, which is largely what we saw back in 13 into 14. So to their credit, they prioritized project management and have done well. They also identified a few other things they're trying to do short term. But I think people, if they don't already know, and most do, they were left, I say they, meaning the state and ultimately Optum, were left with a very serious quantity and quality of problems that required enormous attention and resources. I'm not making excuses, but it was really a mess. So some progress is better than none, although there's still a lot left to be done.
Let's talk about a few generalities, and then we're going to get into some really specific problems that you've identified in the audit and in the report. And then finally, we're going to talk about some of the recommendations that you've made to the state and ideas for how the legislature could have some better oversight of what's going on. One of the major problems you found at the beginning, you know, right from the start, was that the state did not have the time or capacity to do the major IT and systems checks and testing that would have identified some of the problems, and also didn't really have the time to do that, to identify those problems and fix them before we went live on October 1st of 2013. Why was that not possible for the state, Linda Lambert?
That's actually difficult for us to answer, because the focus of our audit was on what are they doing to fix the problems that resulted for what you just described. So our focus was really subsequent to that time frame. But based on my reading of other evaluations that have been done, they hit problems with just the timeline was very aggressive, and they ran out of time. I think they underestimated the complexity of the work that had to be done and how much time it would take to get it done. And as Doug alluded to, they didn't really have the project management skills or processes in place that worked as intended during that time frame.
Can you just tick off a few of the major problems from the start of the health exchange going live that didn't work, so the things that weren't working at the beginning?
Well, I think that you can go back to that it's a they signed the contract with CGI in December of 2012 for an implementation of October 1st, 2013. That's just an extremely short time frame. And the other problem that came up subsequent to that is that they found out that their requirements that they had developed and had defined were not at the detail that they needed to be at for CGI. And so, therefore, they weren't getting what they expected to get. And then I think there was a host of problems with the relationship between CGI and the state as well.
So by way of helping people understand what we're talking about here with, you know, the contractors and testing and implementation, Doug Hoffer, maybe you can just help us understand how this whole system works. So there are patients who are going online trying to put in their information, also trying to get their bills to find out what they owe. Take us from there sort of back through the system, through the screen, and what's working in the background.
Nothing. Well, that's an overstatement. Some of the things that are most important are not working yet. They are manual. You mentioned through the screen, and that's the difference. And anything that's done manually is going to take longer by definition, and it's very frustrating for people. The billing system, the premium payment system is nowhere near where it needs to be. If you get married or move and you have a change of circumstance, you can't do that automatically, as many people have experienced, and there's a significant backlog, as well as renewals. Nothing is automated. That's the problem. And they did a bunch of manual workarounds. But I'm not sure – we didn't look at this, but I'm not sure that the people at the call centers were adequately trained for some of that, or nor do we know for sure that they had enough bodies. To answer your question, how is it working? Not very well.
We're talking today about the Vermont Health Exchange, how it's working or how it's not working, more to the point. And we're getting a look at what the auditor's office has found in its report that just came out recently about what's gone wrong with the health exchange, what needs to be fixed, and some recommendations for how to fix it. Auditor Hoffer, you're holding
up your hand. I just want to add one thing. You asked earlier what Linda found. I want to be clear about what the team did. And I don't have to say why, but we elected last year when we decided to move ahead after several fits and starts to look at the collected works, as it were, of the three or four independent third-party entities which had been paid by the state, to their credit, to look at and critique what was happening on the ground and to provide recommendations. And there were many, I think hundreds. And they're very technical. And it worked for us for a number of reasons, because it was all right there. It allowed us to look at an almost contemporaneous process, because they were in process, as they still are. Furthermore, if we had wanted to look at IT security, we would have had to hire somebody. So anyway, all this work was there. And the question was the state committing the resources at the right time and the right sequence and so forth to get the work done and correct the problems identified? So that's what we did.
Right. So you, in other words, you had all of these other reports that you could build off of to do your work rather than having to start from scratch.
Right.
So listeners, if you're hearing this and you have specific questions about what the auditor's office found about Vermont Health Connect, perhaps you can apply your own experiences with the exchange and we can try to help you understand what's going on in the back end that's not working, that's related to your experience. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts or your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Peter's a good example. He wrote in and says, I applied for coverage in March of 2014, and I did not receive coverage until October of 2014. After filing my taxes, I am now being penalized for the time that I was not covered, even though I was repeatedly told by Health Connect personnel that I would not receive a penalty. This is just one of the many issues I've experienced with the state's program. Peter says, it's time to unplug Vermont Health Connect and seek more organized healthcare solutions for our state. But certainly highlighting one issue here of Peter trying to go in and get his enrollment completed, and it wasn't him, but the exchange was not working for him. And that's something that you found is happening for a lot of people, Linda Lambert.
Yeah, unfortunately, what Peter just outlined is not unusual. And one of the themes, I think, for Vermont Health Connect has been the backlogs that have occurred because of the manual process that Doug alluded to earlier. And at the time of our audit, they had backlogs of a little over 7,000 for both change of circumstances as well as for people who are trying to renew their coverage with changes in for the 2015 plan year. And what has happened is a lot of changes get made, and then they get made several months later, effective earlier. And it just has caused all sorts of problems, not only for customers, but also for the information between the various systems that make up this Vermont Health Connect, and making sure that they're all in sync and have the same information in them.
Doug Hoffer.
One other thing that I'm curious about, and I don't know why they made this decision at the outset, but interposing Benaissance, this third party, people send their checks in response to a bill to Vermont Health Connect. Vermont Health Connect then bundles them and sends them to a third party, which in turn, only when they meet certain requirements, send them back to the carriers. And I should ask Lawrence about that sometime. I don't
– Lawrence Miller, who's in charge of it,
right?
Yeah.
But the carriers themselves, they're in business to bill and receive payments. They know how to do that. So I don't quite know why they made the choice they did in that instance.
To have that third party that has right. to collect all of the money before it even can be sent out to
and
the carriers.
And furthermore, they adopted a policy in the beginning that Benaissance, for its part, could not forward the money to the insurer unless every penny had been received. So if you sent a check in for $1.99 and the premium was $2, they would just hold on to it.
Wow. You know, actually, while we're talking about this, we have another note from Heather in Wethersfield who sort of ties on to what you're talking about. Heather says, I have insurance through Vermont Health Connect and was very supportive of this initiative when it started. But like so many other Vermonters, I'm extremely disappointed and frustrated with the implementation. I'm very aware that our healthcare system in the U.S. is broken, but I feel like we're making it even more complicated. There are many questions, Heather says, but here's one major question that I have. Why is there a payment processor, Benaissance? Is this necessary? It appears to be a perfect example of how to create both an inefficient and ineffective system.
I can't answer the question. I wish I knew. But I think they intend to stay with this model going forward, too.
I think that they have agreed as in their response to our report, because one of our recommendations was that they reconsider the model that they've chosen. And in responding to that recommendation, they said that they will be re-looking at this and reconsidering the choices that they have made.
And the they you're referring to, who are, is this is Lawrence Miller and the
yeah,
people behind
Vermont
Health Connect? Yeah,
it was actually our response came from the Secretary of Human Services.
Okay. So what's the point, though, that the state is trying to accomplish by having this third-party Benaissance?
We really can't answer that.
So if you can't answer that, how's anybody else supposed to understand what that's doing?
Well, at this point, as I said, I'm curious about why that original decision was made, but here we are. So let's work through it and look ahead, which is the whole point of this audit. And now that we've gotten their attention on this and many other things, hopefully they will seriously reconsider this because it doesn't seem to be working very well.
All right. So let's talk about a few of the other things. I have another question before we move on to some more specifics. Did you have any sense or were you able to figure out in any of the research that you've been doing why some other states like Kentucky were able to get this right and we weren't? Is there anything that you've seen in all of these reports that you've looked at and all of the research that you've done?
I can make one comment, and then I think Linda can probably elaborate. I think she knows a lot more than I do. But part of it is CGI. I think many of the states that contracted with CGI had problems, and there were one or two other vendors that did a better job. Also, as I think a lot of people know, it was the intent of the state, and understandably from that perspective a few years back, that since we were by statute headed towards single payer, they wanted to develop a system that would feed into the Agency of Human Services, which is where eligibility is done and so forth, and they were planning another monstrous upgrade over there to replace a system that's terribly out of date that, from the auditor's perspective, needs to be replaced. So they didn't want something off the shelf. They wanted to build something that would fit our needs. In the end, with the short timeline, that was not realistic.
Did you have anything to add to that, Linda?
Well, the system itself is actually largely off the shelf. The difficulty with the system is the integration of all of the parts and the development of how you development of code to make those parts all integrated. The one state that you mentioned, Kentucky, what I've read about Kentucky is that their development effort was simplified, and they did not attempt to put in, shall we say, all the bells and whistles that Vermont was attempting to put in. One thing I don't know about Kentucky, which may have also contributed to this, is the, you know, Vermont was adding in its own set of premium assistance. And that added some complexity to the state's efforts. And so I think the Kentucky example is, you know, or I guess the lesson learned is to try and simplify or to go initially with the simplified version of the system and then add the complexity to it as you go along and you learn from what you've implemented.
Let's go to the calls. Tedder is calling in from Winooski. Hi, Tedder. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes. As a previous worker, Vermont Health Connect, I was a temporary worker, I found that it's very frustrating that, for instance, when somebody had a change of circumstance, that change was under a specific, not necessarily a master ID, but specific case ID, and that when you made that change, potentially the next worker who went in to look for something or possibly send a bill to somebody or update some information, that change wasn't shown up in every single that change wasn't across the board. And I just felt that the system was incredibly clunky trying to look for changes, and there was way too many parts that was necessary to make the system work properly.
So, Heather, you're finding this out.
Sense.
Yeah, and this is from your own experience working within the system.
Exactly.
Have you seen any improvements since we switched contracts last October?
I actually didn't start until November. And I, like I said, I was a temporary worker from November through December. So that was one of my first impressions, that how could this get to be so clunky? And I understand that you need all these pieces to make it work. But the fact that there wasn't one communication system or one change system across the board made it very frustrating for the worker and for the person who you might be dealing with, the customer, because when that customer would call back to check on something, I would say, I don't see the change of address. You know, you have to go look. And sometimes it would take hours just to deal with one customer on figuring out when a change was made.
Tedder, thanks for calling us and thanks for sharing your experience. It's interesting to hear what it's like for somebody who's working, you know, for Vermont Health Connect trying to make this system work. Auditor Hoffer, what are you thinking?
I'm thinking back to something Linda said about the bells and whistles. Presumably we would have done better had we not been so optimistic about what we could accomplish. But looking ahead, which is important, particularly in the context of why we selected these objectives, because at that time, we still believed we were headed for single payer.
Mm-hmm.
And Vermonters, I think, myself included, were anxious to know whether the state could manage this system. It's very large, it's complex, and we were anxious to get from here to there. However, even though, for the moment at least, we're not headed towards single payer, as I mentioned briefly in passing before, the Agency of Human Services is faced with the need, the absolute critical need, to replace this system called Access, which is, 25 years old, and is used by most of AHS and is critical to the state. So there are some who say, well, let's just drop it, let's move on. We are seeing evidence that the state has learned some lessons from this and are beginning to apply them. We're not done with the exchange, of course, but to the extent we can keep moving, we can use the lessons learned for the Access replacement later on.
Yeah, because we've seen frequently in state government, IT problems really hamper our ability to have functionality in many, many of the systems that the state is trying to work with.
Right.
Okay, we're talking today about Vermont Health Connect, the health exchange website that the state's been using. We're talking with State Auditor Doug Hoffer and Linda Lambert, another auditor with the auditor's office. She was in charge of this report that just came out. And we're getting some of the takeaways from what they've found and what they think will help improve the situation. Coming up, we're going to talk about maybe what's happening with functionality, any main problems being fixed. What's the likelihood that the state will meet its end of May deadline for a major fix, and what's the risk involved there? If you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at Vermont Health Connect with Doug Hoffer, state auditor, and with Linda Lambert, also with the auditor's office. She's the director of information technology and performance audits, and she was the manager for the Vermont Health Connect audit. We're discussing the report's findings and what these two state officials think need to be done to fix the problems that they've found. The audit makes several recommendations to the state and to the legislature. We're going to go over some of them. We're also hearing from some of you about problems that you've seen seen with Vermont Health Connect and what you'd like to know about how to fix it. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We were just talking about IT systems, and Balu has a comment about that, writing, "It's not anything unusual that IT projects have gone the disaster route. This is not the first time, besides being Health Connect being much more complex. One solution the state should look at is open source platform. Besides being free of licensing restrictions, it can also prevent vendor lock-ins. All tax-funded IT projects should be open source, and the source code should be posted for the public to read. If you take that route, it's very easy to manage these solutions. Contractors can be easily replaced with better ones if we happen to falter hiring the original one. This also saves a ton of dollars, federal or state." We're also hearing from some people about their own experiences. Marcy in South Burlington says she sent a letter to the governor and to Vermont Health Connect, and she shared that part of what she wrote says, "As part of a family paying nearly $17,000 in premiums for 1 year of silver family coverage for a healthy family and dental coverage for two adults, outrageously expensive, not affordable, I think our costs could go down significantly if you made a greater effort to save money. For example," Marcy writes, "our latest bill included one page of paper that was completely blank on both sides except for the words, 'Sincerely, Vermont Health Connect,' and a second page, two-thirds of which was completely blank on two sides. The remaining third contained the payment voucher on one side. When I think of all the bills that were sent out, I'm shocked that the state of Vermont could have such a high disregard for wasting Vermont Health Connect payer and taxpayer funds. Please hire someone who has both common sense and a cost-benefit orientation so such waste can be stopped immediately." Perhaps a low-grade problem, as these problems go, for Vermont Health Connect, but still, you know, Marcy saying, all these problems and you're sending me blank pages and I'm paying $17,000 a year. Let's go to Joseph calling in from Lindenville. Hi, Joseph. You're on.
Hi there. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just staggered as I listen to the woman from South Burlington. Most of us are reading the papers and trying to keep up with this issue and trying to keep up with what government is doing in general this difficult year. And we're staggered by listening to the amount of wasted taxpayer dollars that went into this project. I don't know what the final number is, but it's got to be huge. And the question is, how can we afford to make mistakes so big? And what can we do to prevent those from happening again in the future? This is as close to malpractice as anything I've seen, and I'm just wondering what we can do about it.
Joseph, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Can you put a final number on what the state has spent so far in the original concept of trying to get Vermont Health Connect up and running and what we've spent in putting these sort of Band-Aid fixes on?
Well, I can tell you that the federal government has paid for most of the design, development, and implementation thus far. The grants that the state received were $198.7 million. As of the end of December 2014, the state had paid $126.7 million of that, or had paid invoices or internally for $126.7 million of that. Now, that number is understated because there are costs that have been incurred that have not been reported yet, largely because there's a time lag between when invoices received or when the work has been done versus the invoices received versus the payment has been made. But those are what the numbers that we have right now.
So, and what you're saying is that $127 million that the state has paid out, that's all coming from these federal grants?
Yes.
So that makes it sound like Vermont taxpayers specifically have not had to shell out any money for this.
For the development of the system, I think that has been all federal money. The operations of the system, however, does, at least to some extent, fall on Vermont taxpayers. Specifically, other than, you know, Vermont taxpayers as part of the state or
the federal,
U.S. as a
sure.
whole.
And Doug Hofford, do you know how much that has cost Vermont taxpayers?
We don't yet, but we do know that the Affordable Care Act requires the states who have an exchange to submit to CMS, the Medicare and Medicaid folks, a plan, a so-called sustainability plan that will describe in some detail how we intend to pay for the operation of the system going forward. And Linda, I'm not sure, but we haven't put that plan together yet, have we?
I believe that plan has been submitted.
Okay.
We're talking today about Vermont Health Connect. If you have questions or comments, you can post them on the VPR.net Vermont Edition page or call 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Mary, who's calling in from Peru. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I have maybe it's an unusual situation. I'm not sure. But I did enroll with Vermont Health Connect in November, sent in my first premium payment, got my cards, started thinking about the subsidy. I thought I was probably entitled to a larger subsidy. Called them back to have them recalculate it. They said, indeed, I was entitled to a larger supplement. However, since then, since that phone call, I have not received another invoice. Called them in January, February, March, got a facilitator to help me. They couldn't get it done. Moved on to an advocate. They can't seem to get it done. This weekend, I got a letter from Vermont Health Connect with a check, a refund check for my first premium payment, and they informed me that they've canceled my insurance.
Wow, Mary.
So I don't know where to go from here.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. Doug Hoffer, what Mary's been experiencing is something that you have found as a big fault in the system.
Indeed, and we do get communications periodically in the office from folks who are frustrated. And we don't have the wherewithal or the knowledge to help them immediately, but we always send them to the ombudsman or the ombudsperson's office, Trinka and her colleagues, and we always hear that they are very effective in a very short period of time. So I would encourage Mary to give them a call. I wish I had the number with me. I don't.
What about this issue, though, with people not getting their invoices for payments, not figuring out what their premium is, and then not being able to have the state stay up and keep pace with them as their circumstances change in terms of how much money they're making through the year and how the premiums should fluctuate with their circumstances? Mary? Linda, rather?
It's a very common problem. At the time we did our audit, and I think it was as of March 9th, there was over 7,000 renewals with changes, such as what Mary described, that were still being processed or in some part of the process, so they had not gone through, and those changes had not been made at the carrier level yet. So therefore, people were not getting invoices, and the expectation is that, you know, people will be getting invoices when the change is made, and that those invoices will cover several months worth of payments.
And so then they'll be expected to pay several months at once.
Correct.
And if they don't, Benaissance won't forward any of it back to the carrier.
Is there any sense that the state might forego some of that money, given that the state is causing problems for patients and for people who are doing their best and working with the state to try to make their payments?
That's an interesting question. I think Blue Cross Blue Shield has an interest in the answer to that question.
So, in other words, Blue Cross Blue Shield still wants to make sure it gets its money for the services that are being rendered.
Right.
Speaking of carriers, you know, I think often people don't have a lot of sympathy for insurance carriers, but it seems that in this system, they are not finding the system is working for them either. So Blue Cross, Blue Shield, MVP, they're not finding that this is working for them. Is that accurate? Is that correct that they're struggling with this system as well?
I think it is, and it's fair to say that while you're correct that most people historically don't like their insurance companies, in this case, the story is that they've worked very hard to accommodate the state, recognizing the problems that we've experienced and have gone quite a ways to help us out.
Let me ask you a question about security, because one of the problems that was found now, we're several months beyond this, but was that patient information had been compromised. Has that been fixed? Have the IT issues that led to the vulnerability of patient information been fixed in the system?
I'm Linda. Not aware that patient information has been compromised. I'm not sure what you're alluding to.
There was a time, so the specific circumstance that I'm remembering is when two people with the same name were trying to get their whole system set up, and one of those patients accessed the other patient's information. So that patient was able to see somebody else's information. That's the one I'm remembering.
Right. And that created a problem for Mark when he testified. As it happens, for a variety of reasons, we did not look specifically at IT security for this reason. The federal government is in the process of or is about to initiate an audit of IT security specifically, so we didn't want to cross paths with them.
Okay, so that's not in the audit.
Is that fair to say, Linda?
I mean, you do mention IT security and
– Right. So the way that we approached IT security is we were looking at the controls that were identified as weaknesses and then looking to the extent to which those controls had been fixed as of the end of January in this case. And we summarized what that was.
So – in terms of what's supposed to happen by the end of May, one of the things the state is trying to fix right now is the ability to automate changes to customers' accounts, this idea of change of circumstances. We've been talking a little bit about that. The state says problems like that are going to be fixed in this rollout, supposed to come at the end of May. Your report casts doubt on whether or not that deadline will be met. Linda, why?
Primarily because it's a very tight time frame. It's a They have in their schedule plans for testing, but as most people know who are involved in system development efforts, things often don't go as expected during testing. And there's not a lot of play in the schedule that would allow, if there are significant defects found, time to fix and then retest the software to make sure that not only are those defects corrected, but that they didn't cause that the fix didn't cause other problems. So a lot of this occurs at the end of the process, as it typically does, and there's just not a lot of time that's allowed in the schedule.
And for the fall rollout of other fixes that are supposed to happen, there's competition for staff and technical resources that you've identified, and the absence of a contract even now to complete that fall rollout.
Right. I think they're working on developing a scope and the contract, but I think in each instance with all the amendments, it's been a little late.
It's my understanding that they have negotiated a contract, and that contract is with the federal government for their approval right now. But that is a lengthy process, and I'm not sure what their final time frame is for when they'll get it signed. They have a current contract with Optum that expires June 30th of this year.
So let me tick through a couple of the recommendations that you've put out in this report. You say that project management plan still hasn't been fully finalized for the two major fixes that are supposed to be happening this year. You want that to happen expeditiously. You think there needs to be a contract the state has with Optum or any other contractor that has financial penalties for not meeting the deadlines that are agreed upon. And you have similar recommendations about holding contractors to some service level minimum so that there are penalties if they can't meet those services. A couple other recommendations you have as well, but let me ask you this, Auditor Hoffer. I know you try to stay away from the politics, but you acknowledge in the report this is all framed by a discussion we're having in our state about whether or not we should just ditch the state exchange and go to the federal exchange or not. What do you think? Should we?
Well, this isn't Las Vegas. I can't handicap the race here, but I hope they make it, obviously. I think most people do. As to whether we go to the federal, our recommendation in that regard is not yes or no, but if we move in that direction and we need to prepare for that, do the analyses required, involve as many parties as possible, do cost-benefit and so forth. And if we don't do that, then it's not an informed decision.
Do you agree, Linda?
Yes. I think it's extremely important that they make a analytical assessment of not only where they are now, but where they want to be in the future. And I think a cost-benefit analysis is a critical element of that.
All right. That's Linda Lambert, who's with the Auditor's Office. She's the Director of Information Technology and Performance Audits. She was the manager for the Vermont Health Connect audit. We've also been speaking with Doug Hoffer, the state auditor. As I said at the top of the show, it's some great beach reading. If you want to read the report, we'll put a link to it at vpr.net. Doug Hoffer also referred to the state healthcare ombudsman at Vermont Legal Aid. Their phone number is 1-800-917-7789. 1-800-917-7787. Again, that's 1-800-917-7787, and we'll try to put that up at vpr.net as well for people who want to get that number. Thanks to both of you for being on the program today. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Jen.
Okay. Coming up, we're going to celebrate the birthday of the Hubble Telescope, which has helped physicists and astronomers grapple with big questions about space and time. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. 25 years ago this week, the Hubble Space Telescope was launched into orbit. Since 1990, it's been capturing crystal clear images of stellar nurseries, planetary rings, and distant galaxies. Well, actually, those images have only been really crystal clear since 1993, because the original lens in the telescope was basically not measured correctly. Astronauts had to go up and fix it. But since then, the Hubble Telescope has been responsible for some major astronomical breakthroughs relating to space and time. Astronomers, professors, even amateurs can apply for time to use the telescope themselves, directing its view from Earth to capture images for study. St. Michael's College professor John O'Mara has done just that three different times, and he's going to be celebrating the telescope's anniversary this week. Professor O'Mara, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So tick off a couple of the great breakthroughs that the Hubble has had a part in.
Oh, well, the list would take many hours to go through, but I think some of my personal favorites are Hubble recently has been able to take images of stars, planets around other stars. We were actually able to take images of these things, and we're also able to use the spectra of the atmospheres of these planets to actually figure out what's in the atmospheres of planets around other stars.
Wow.
Hubble has been able to revolutionize our understanding of the entire universe by constraining this dark energy, which it takes up about 70% of the energy density of the universe. And this is something that we didn't know about at all when Hubble launched. And since then, we've really changed our view of the universe with it. Hubble has revolutionized our understanding of how big the universe is, the scale of the universe through its deep fields, and we've pushed farther and farther back our ability to find objects farther back in space and farther back in time.
As I mentioned, you've actually been principal investigator on three different Hubble programs. My understanding is that, sort of simplified, that means you get to decide where to point the telescope.
Yeah.
What are you looking for?
Well, I look at very distant objects called quasars. They're very bright, and they serve as background light bulbs. And I try to figure out how the universe works by doing science in silhouette. When the gas from a galaxy or a group of galaxies get in the way of the quasar, the light is changed. And from that, we can figure out what large swaths of the universe is made out of.
Wow. And was it fun? Was it, I mean,
oh, yeah.
Did it feel cool to be directing the Hubble?
It's a really good day when you can wake up and say, this morning I told Hubble where to point. That's a good day.
So this is coming up on the 25th anniversary, which of course means that Hubble was launched in 1990. And the only way to service it is to actually send astronauts up to physically do the work in space required to repair it or to replace parts. That first service mission in 1993 corrected kind of an embarrassing misstep in the original work done on the telescope's lens. Can you explain what that was?
Sure. When Hubble launched, you know, it has this mirror that's about 8 feet across, 2.4 meters in diameter. And that mirror has to be exceedingly well figured. You have to know all parts of the mirror extremely well to get a very, very crisp image. And of course, putting a telescope in space, you can have very, very crisp images if the mirror is made well. Well, the device they used to test the figuring of that mirror was actually assembled slightly incorrectly, and as a result, said that the mirror was fine when it wasn't.
Mm. So that first service mission repaired that. There, I think, have been four service missions since that one. Is that
right? Yeah, there's been a total of five servicing missions since then. One of them was broken up into two parts.
And the last one was in 2009. So what happens now that the space shuttle program has been retired that would, you know, ostensibly send those astronauts up to do that work?
Well, unless we can find a different way to get astronauts up there, or unless we can come up with a robotic servicing mission, there will be no more missions to service Hubble. The good news is that all of the instruments in there are working well. Hubble is churning out the best science it ever has in terms of productivity and sort of impact, and it's going strong. And we plan on using it at least for the next 5 years, hopefully more.
So you think you could get it to 2020 before it starts to shut down?
Oh, that's our absolute goal. I mean, we're viewing 2020 as a minimum.
And then what? How do we get it down?
Well, that's a sort of delicate procedure. There's a ring that was put on the base of the telescope in the last servicing mission so that something could be flown up to dock to the back of it and elegantly deorbit, as it were. That basically means have it burn up in the atmosphere.
Ah, so it's not like we're going to get to bring it down and then put it in the Smithsonian.
I would love to see it in the Air and Space Museum. There's a wonderful mock-up of it that looks exactly like it, but I would love to see the real thing.
There is a new telescope that's being launched in a couple of years. Can you explain what the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to do that Hubble can't?
Sure. The James Webb Space Telescope is a much, much larger telescope. That's its primary advantage over Hubble. Hubble, like I said, is about 2.4 meters in diameter. James Webb is going to be 6.5 meters big, so in diameter. So it's much, much larger. It will be able to see objects which are much, much fainter. And usually in astronomy, fainter means farther away. It'll also be optimized for infrared light. Hubble sees light in the ultraviolet portion of the spectrum, the visible portion, what we can see with our eyes, and a little bit in the infrared. Webb is going to be finely tuned for infrared, and the reason why they want to do that is because they want to capture the light from the most distant galaxies that we can find, and that's primarily in the infrared. So Hubble has really opened our eyes onto the scope of the universe, and Webb is just going to take that and run with it, gangbusters.
And how will Webb be serviced given that we're not sending astronauts up to do the work even on Hubble?
Well, Webb won't be serviced. The Hubble Space Telescope orbits in low Earth orbit, a few hundred miles up. Webb is going to be flying way out to what we call a Lagrange point, where the gravitational forces from the Earth and the Sun balance out. And it's going to sit there and it won't be serviced. It's going to be too far away unless we can really cook up something interesting to do with astronauts.
So NASA better get it right the first time.
NASA better get it right the first time.
How are you going to be marking the 25th anniversary of the Hubble telescope this week?
Well, we've got a couple of events coming up. Tomorrow at the ECHO, we've got an event at 4 p.m. Designed more for children, with a variety of hands-on activities and whatnot, mostly just some really cool images.
And then, that's the Echo Lake Aquarium in Burlington.
That's correct. And then at 6 p.m. on Friday at St. Michael's College in the Charest Science Building, Room 101, I'll be leading a presentation with a talk. We'll have a couple of hands-on activities and, if the weather permits, some stargazing outside with a NASA ambassador.
And does it excite you to talk about Hubble?
Every day. I get jazzed up every day when I get to talk about Hubble.
John O'Meara is an associate professor of physics at St. Michael's College. He's been drawing our focus to the Hubble Space Telescope, launched into orbit 25 years ago this Friday. Professor O'Meara, are you going to make a cake or anything?
Now that you ask, yes. Yes, I will.
All right. Well, we want to see a picture of it. If you could shape it into the shape of the telescope, that would be perfect.
That's probably beyond my skill set, but I'll try.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This past Saturday, the U.S. Post Office in Danville, Vermont, was renamed for Civil War-era Congressman Thaddeus Stevens. Stevens was born in Danville in April of 1792, and he went on to represent Lancaster, Pennsylvania, during the volatile debates over ending slavery and Reconstruction. Beverly Wilson Palmer is a research associate at Pomona College. She has edited the speeches and letters of Thaddeus Stevens.
He was such a strong anti-slavery leader and an excellent legislator. He really knew how to work his way through Congress and was very, very important in getting through the 13th and the 14th Amendments in Congress. He did not live to see the 15th Amendment, but he was certainly working for that. And I think there was a lot of credit given to Stevens for showing how he was able to compromise. He was quite a fiery orator and in many ways did not want to compromise, but he was canny enough to know that sometimes you have to.
Despite leaving Vermont at age 23, Palmer says Stevens' home state played an important role in his life.
There are some papers at the Peachum Historical Society. He was born in Danville, and of course that's where the post office is going to be. And then went to the Peachum Academy and had a lot of strong ties to Vermont, even though he left soon after he had graduated from Dartmouth. He went to Pennsylvania, where, of course, is where he's noticed and has been noted for his work as a legislator from Pennsylvania. But his ties to Vermont were very strong. He returned frequently. His mother lived to a great age, and he would come back and visit her, and he kept ties with some of the Vermonters. And so I think Vermont was a very important part of his background, of his heritage.
In addition to the Danville Post Office, there are at least three schools named for him, one in Washington, D.C., one in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and the Thaddeus Stevens School in Linden Center, Vermont. All right, the Vermont Crime Information Center has a lot on its plate. It maintains the state's sex offender registry, oversees marijuana dispensaries and the list of patients, and it keeps the state's crime statistics. Tomorrow on this show, we'll look at the center, its expanding responsibilities, and the big challenges it faces. You can send your questions or comments about the Vermont Crime Information Center and all that it tracks by writing to Vermont Edition at vpr.net, and then listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.